Hello and welcome to this podcast focusing on current approaches and future directions in early-stage triple-negative breast cancer. In this episode, which includes excerpts from a recent online educational activity, Drs. Noor Abuhadra and Antonio Giordano will discuss patient selection for antibody-drug conjugates in early-stage triple-negative breast cancer, current best practices for neoadjuvant and adjuvant therapy, and how these emerging agents may be integrated into clinical practice. This activity is provided by PER and supported by an educational grant from Gilead Sciences, Inc. In the first segment, Dr. Abuhadra discusses how to select the most appropriate patients for antibody-drug conjugates in early-stage triple-negative breast cancer.
Hello, I'm now going to be reviewing how we select the right patients for ADCs in that early-stage triple-negative breast cancer space. I'm highlighting here a few of the key ongoing post-neoadjuvant ADC trials. There's TROPION-Breast03 here. This is actually close to accrual, but awaiting results, evaluating Dato with or without Durva in the post-neoadjuvant residual disease setting with a primary endpoint of invasive disease-free survival. Similarly, there's ASCENT-05 or OPTIMIZE-RD, which is evaluating sacituzumab govitecan with pembrolizumab versus our current standard of care, capecitabine with pembro. And finally, there's TROFUSE-012 or MK-2870, which is evaluating SAC-TMT, another TROP2 ADC with pembrolizumab compared to physician's choice adjuvant therapy, which again remains capecitabine with pembro at this current time. And so as we think about how to select the most appropriate patients to enroll on these studies, of course, the most important piece is that these are patients who have residual disease after completing neoadjuvant therapy. This represents a patient population with very poor prognosis and an incredibly high risk of recurrence. And this is, again, a population with an unmet need of rescue therapy after surgery. The prior neoadjuvant regimen received does play a role here in terms of selecting patients. For now, most of these trials actually do require that patients have completed anthracycline and taxane-based chemotherapy with or without immunotherapy. And more often than not, that means our standard of care, KEYNOTE-522. But patients who receive perhaps unconventional regimens may be excluded from these post-neoadjuvant ADC trials. Of course, the expectation is baseline organ function is normal and that patients don't have any pre-existing risk factors, in particular when we're thinking about toxicities like ILD, pneumonitis, and such. And finally, of course, there's that timing relative to surgery. Patients need to be within that 4 to 12 weeks of definitive surgery to try to balance that wound healing against their risk of relapse. I think one of the most challenging things here, as hopefully more of these ADCs get approved in this setting, is how we select the right ADC for the right patient. And so many of these ADCs are actually TROP2 targeting ADCs. And you can see, though, from our metastatic setting studies that TROP2 expression is really not the cleanest predictive marker. We've seen activity of these drugs across TROP2 expression. And so this hasn't kind of emerged as our biomarker of choice in terms of guiding ADC use. We've seen some interesting data in the metastatic setting, again, in the BRCA population, seeing improved response rates in response to TROP2 ADCs. This is all still quite investigational, but calls into question whether HRD status may help select for ADCs in this setting and even in the metastatic setting. So that's a little bit of a to be determined. When it comes to trying to identify a single biomarker, so far it's been challenging to find one single biomarker that can point towards predictive value, but I-SPY 2.2 that we reviewed shows that perhaps a multi-marker classify rather than a single IHC cutoff is the way to go. And so we'll see as we review more data coming out of I-SPY 2.2, how predictive these response predictive subtypes are. And finally, we've had TILs and ctDNA for some time now, and many studies that have demonstrated their prognostic impact and benefit. But I think what's challenging is determining whether or not these are going to be predictive for ADCs in particular. And so there are many studies that are still trying to assess whether TILs and ctDNA may help guide us in ADC selection. some key considerations when we're thinking about ADC monotherapy versus ADC plus immunotherapy in the neoadjuvant and adjuvant settings. I think we've seen now for some time that when we think about the neoadjuvant setting, there's definitely a benefit to having that intact tumor or positive lymph nodes favoring that antigen load supporting T cell priming when you're giving immunotherapy. Another benefit to assessing the role of ADCs versus IO ADC in the neoadjuvant setting is, of course, PathCR is this actionable near-term endpoint. You're not waiting for invasive disease-free survival or EFS data to evolve or mature. The other thing and benefit with neoadjuvant setting evaluation is, of course, you have this shorter defined treatment window, so you're limiting that cumulative toxicity that we sometimes see with adjuvant studies. And finally, there's definitely an appetite in the oncology community for response-adapted chemo de-escalation and combination strategies. So I think the neoadjuvant setting is definitely a very attractive place to assess the benefit of ADC mono versus immunotherapy in ADC. When it comes to the adjuvant setting, we've seen many adjuvant IO studies now demonstrating no added benefit. And so there is that concern that we're losing antigen-rich priming. The other concern with many of the adjuvant setting studies is that these tend to have longer treatment durations, sometimes up to 1 year, which does kind of raise that cumulative toxicity stakes for patients. I mentioned this already, but event-free survival and invasive disease-free survival are endpoints that require many years of follow-up. And so having that near-term endpoint, like a PathCR, does allow for practice changes much sooner. And I think finally, there are many ongoing studies right now, like TROPION-Breast03 and ASCENT-05, that are hopefully going to directly assess whether the addition of immunotherapy in the adjuvant setting is going to be beneficial.
In the next segment, Dr. Giordano discusses current best practices for neoadjuvant and adjuvant therapy in early-stage triple-negative breast cancer.
Let's take a look at the current best practice for neoadjuvant therapy in early-stage triple-negative breast cancer. The landscape in triple-negative breast cancer has radically changed with the KEYNOTE-522 regimen, and the study that just few weeks ago was presented with the final analysis that the ASCO 2026 is a study of neoadjuvant chemotherapy with a complex chemotherapy regimen, including carboplatin and paclitaxel, followed by anthracycline and cyclophosphamide, randomized to placebo or the same regimen plus pembrolizumab. After surgery, patients were continuing the pembrolizumab in the experimental arm for up to 9 cycles when the pembrolizumab was given every 3 weeks. The final analysis, as I said, was just presented, and we know that the addition of immunotherapy really markedly improved the event-free survival, both in the patient that did not achieve a pathologic complete response. You can see here the difference is in terms of about 8% with a hazard ratio 0.78, 57.6% for the patient that received pembro versus 49.7% in the patient that did not receive pembrolizumab. And also in the patient that achieved the pathologic complete response, we can actually see a difference, even though it was not statistically significant, with an hazard ratio of 0.68 and the confidence interval that crosses the boundary, but still there is about a 4% percentage in favor of the combination chemotherapy pembrolizumab. What we want to show here, though, is that especially in the patient that did not achieve a pathologic complete response, the event-free survival are still pretty low, and these patients carry a poor prognosis that additional treatment options are really needed in the post-neoadjuvant setting. There are also alternative regimen to the KEYNOTE-522, and with the NeoPact, we actually have seen that in a anthracycline free chemotherapy regimen, the combination of docetaxel, carboplatin with pembrolizumab, also achieved quite important response rate in terms of complete response rate and event-free survival that were even though with a short follow-up around 3 year EFS of 98% in the patient achieving a PCR and 68% patient with residual disease. Again, the need of additional targeted agent in the post-adjuvant setting that aim to improve the recurrence-free survival and the distant-free survival that, to really impact the overall survival in these like poor risk subtype of breast cancer. In this time, while all the post-adjuvant clinical trial, including ADC, are awaiting to read, the treatment we offer our patients includes in the patient with residual disease without the germline mutation, capecitabine for 6-8 cycles. So those are data that comes from the Asian study of the CREAT-X, the randomized patient with residual disease. Majority of the patient on this in this trial were triple negative breast cancer, but some hormone receptor positive were included. But here in those curves that are specifically for triple negative breast cancer, you can see that adding capecitabine improved the disease-free survival from 56.1% to 69.8% with a hazard ratio of 58%, 0.58. And then overall survival also increased with the hazard ratio of 0.52 in favor of capecitabine. And when we apply the CREAT-X to KEYNOTE-522, again, in the original trial, the KEYNOTE-522, patients were not actually allowed to receive capecitabine because these were they're really not overlap while the KEYNOTE-522 was designed. But today we extrapolate the data and the especially for the safety, we are comfortable using a combination of capecitabine with pembrolizumab in patients with residual disease and that are continuing the KEYNOTE-522 regimen with pembrolizumab after a non-PCR after surgery. In the germline BRCA1/2 pathogenic variants, high risk, the OlympiA trial has shown, and especially in triple negative breast cancer, an important improvement in the distant disease-free survival and overall survival with 1 year of adjuvant olaparib at 300 milligram twice a day in patients with residual disease. So we have widely adopted the use of olaparib in patients with the not PCR after the KEYNOTE-522, and we do have also safety to support the combination of olaparib with the pembrolizumab in this post-adjuvant setting. Again, the use of pembrolizumab in the adjuvant setting for patients achieving a pathologic complete response has also been addressed in other trial. Optimized PCR, for example, is looking at dropping the pembrolizumab in patients that achieved a pathologic complete response, but the data are for now not ready and this, they were not presented yet.
In the final segment, Doctors Giordano and Abu-Hadra review a case regarding antibody drug conjugate use in early stage triple negative breast cancer.
So this case is a 36-year-old premenopausal woman with no significant past medical history. She's diagnosed with stage 2, so clinical T2N1 triple negative breast cancer, receives neoadjuvant therapy according to the KEYNOTE-522 regimen, and unfortunately her surgical pathology reveals residual invasive disease in both the breast and one axillary lymph node. Her germline testing is negative.
Okay, so Dr. Abu-Hadra, based on the extended a very nice review of the clinical trial for the post-adjuvant setting, would you consider enrolling this patient in one of the ADC trial, like for example, the ASCENT-05 or the TROPION-Breast03 or TROFUSE? And what are the key eligibility criteria and the characteristics of this case that will direction you to a study versus another one?
I think this is a key candidate for a study like that in the post neoadjuvant setting. It's a young patient who received extensive neoadjuvant treatment, and this is carboplatin, AC, and pembro, and unfortunately has in residual disease. In terms of key eligibility criteria, typically across the board, these studies require residual disease in either the breast or the lymph nodes. And many of them do have that germline testing requirement where if patients do harbor a BRCA1 or 2 mutation, they may not be eligible for the study. As of right now, our standard of care is capecitabine with or without the adjuvant immunotherapy. And that's a really, distressing option to share with patients to tell them, your disease is very highly resistant to chemotherapy, and my only option for you is to give you another oral chemotherapy. And so this is absolutely a patient I would screen for one of these studies. As far as selecting one of these studies, that's challenging. I think ultimately what it actually comes down to in practice is what study is available nearby, right? What study do you have open at your site? As of right now, there's no signal to suggest that one of these ADCs may be better than the other. The addition of immunotherapy on top of the ADC is going to be better than the other. So whatever we can offer them beyond capecitabine, I think, is an important consideration.
Would the toxicity profile that the patient experienced during the neoadjuvant journey influence, for example, the choice on which type of ADC we are going to pick and if we are going to continue doing immunotherapy versus single agent ADC?
I think that there's a few considerations here. First and foremost, many of us have a lot of experience with these ADCs, whether that be sacituzumab govitecan or Dato-DXd in the metastatic setting. But I definitely think, of course, our threshold for those toxicities is different in that curative intent setting, when at where our kind of willingness to accept something like an ILD risk is a little different than in our metastatic patients. As far as the toxicity profile of any of these ADCs, in general, there's the question of course, cytopenias, and often that just means adding support. With regards to long-term toxicities coming out of a regimen like KEYNOTE-522, neuropathy is always a consideration, but thankfully those don't seem to be primary toxicities related to these ADCs, so that's less of a concern. I think one thing that I also do wonder about, and I don't think there's a lot of data on, is for these younger patients thinking about ovarian preservation. There's not really a lot of data as far as GnRH agonists and what their role is in terms of preserving their ovarian function. And so that's always a very tough conversation to have with patients, younger patients going on these types of studies, is that I can't really promise or share data on the benefit or success rates of GnRH agonists with these ADCs. But those are certainly, I think, the main things I discuss with patients going into these studies.
I think it's going to be really important, for example, to dissect the toxicity profile of the post-adjuvant ADC study and figure out the different toxicity of the different ADC, and then maybe tailor the choice of the ADC based on the and on how they have previously tolerated the KEYNOTE-522 regimen that we know very well. It's not one of the easiest chemotherapy regimen our patient received with breast cancer. So definitely I feel like the safety profile of the different ADC can be targeted based on the tox profile, and immunotherapy as well may be dropped, for example, in patients that did not tolerate immunotherapy or had like special interest side effects associated to immunotherapy. Now, assuming that we are seeing the patient actually at the diagnosis, so before the neoadjuvant regimen was prescribed, what are the characteristics of the patient that will actually make you choose to prefer a neoadjuvant ADC approach versus, for example, the KEYNOTE-522 regimen. And now we have seen the final data just recently and very well established.
Do you mean selecting Keynote at all or neoadjuvant ADC?
Correct. Like, how do we select? Like, what are the characteristics that will make you select an ADC neoadjuvantly
Yeah.
rather than the KEYNOTE-522 regimen?
Absolutely. So, I think that we have some studies evaluating this whole idea of chemotherapy de-escalation in the absence even of an ADC, right? So there's the NeoPACT studies and things of that nature, which have demonstrated that perhaps patients with smaller tumors, perhaps some node involvement, not too heavy on the nodal involvement, high stromal TILs, certain kind of characteristics pathologically that encourage thinking about a de-escalated regimen already, perhaps an anthracycline-free regimen. I think those are patients, perhaps just as a clinician, I would feel more comfortable exploring that de-escalated ADC in the neoadjuvant setting. I guess this is partly kind of dependent on the way protocols are written. I do like that adaptive radiographic monitoring involved. And so that gives me comfort if I'm looking at a neoadjuvant ADC study that has radiographic assessments folded in, gives me a little bit more comfort. And I think gives the patients a little more comfort when they're kind of embarking on an entirely experimental neoadjuvant type study. Anything that you would consider when you're thinking about enrolling these patients in these ADC studies?
I think you bring up two different points that are very important. One could be, for example, the stage of disease, and in a patient that is, for example, a stage two, so with the limited nodal burden, something that we are thinking about de-escalating strategy would probably be a better candidate for a de-escalation strategy with a single agent ADC. And the other one could be in patients that are more frail, so elderly, that we don't know and we don't feel confident about how they are going to handle the KEYNOTE-522 or the NeoPACT regimen. Maybe a de-escalation strategy with a single agent ADC sometimes could be the preferred option. I feel it is going to be important to consider also the event-free survival, because so far we have only seen the pathologic complete response rate. And again, while in triple-negative breast cancer, as for HER2 positive, the PathCR is an excellent surrogate endpoint. I do think that with the single agent ADC, a look at the event-free survival and prolonged follow-up would be important overall to implement those strategy in our clinical practice. And then, Dr. Abudara, how would you potentially look at the long-term toxicity, specifically of the ADC versus the KEYNOTE-522, and how do you factor that in the discussion with the patient on, like, which strategy do you prefer, and like which ADC do you prefer?
Yeah, I think, when we're thinking about what are the most common toxicities that may carry over from one treatment paradigm to the next, hematologic toxicities are always going to be the most prevalent, I think. And we certainly see much more of a dive with sacituzumab, for example, in especially in that post-neoadjuvant setting when patients have already been exposed to kind of multiple cycles of cytotoxic chemotherapy. That's always kind of a really, I think, pivotal part of the discussion for patients and preparing them for that need for G-CSF support. I think another thing transitioning from that KEYNOTE-522 into the ADCs for adjuvant setting is GI toxicities. And we know that that's particularly SN38 mediated, especially with drugs like sacituzumab govitecan. And I think that calls into question kind of what kind of genetic testing we're also doing prior to assess their tolerability of that agent. And especially in our younger patients, but to within all of our patients, I think early intervention is key no matter which path we take. So thinking about things like early intervention with loperamide and discussing with patients kind of more of an anticipatory approach as opposed to a reactive approach when it comes to these risks. And finally, I think when it comes to just that overarching ILD risk, it's just so important to provide that patient education to be aware of what to look out for. Sometimes, it's something as simple as a lingering dry cough for several weeks, but if a patient doesn't express that to us, it can really have quite devastating consequences. I think one thing when thinking about the whole chemo ADC IO debate as well is, we've seen some data from our colleagues in melanoma and thoracic about what this means for patients with pre-existing autoimmune conditions. Again, it's a little bit of unknown territory when it comes to ADCs, but certainly that's always a consideration, right? If I can offer a patient an IO-free regimen that's just as good, I think that matters, particularly for our patients with conditions like Crohn's disease, lupus, and such.
And as a final note, let's keep talking about de-escalating. Let's assume that this patient is actually has a germline BRCA1/2 testing that is positive. When would you consider actually offering a completely chemo-free regimen with the PARP inhibitor plus an immuno checkpoint inhibitor?
In the neoadjuvant setting, or
Correct. In the neoadjuvant setting.
So, there was that data that came out of MD Anderson NeoTALA that looked at just single agent talazoparib in the neoadjuvant setting. I think it was something like 24 weeks of neoadjuvant PARP inhibitor, and the path CR rates were about 43% or so. Incredibly encouraging to think about a completely chemo-free. I mean, a pill, to think about sitting a patient down and saying you're going to take a pill for 24 weeks and then we can go to surgery is, I think, going to be a huge shift for patients, hopefully. And I think we've seen that that potential combination with immunotherapy may even augment that path CR rate. So very excited to see how that story evolves, and I hope that we continue to dive into that potential. I think what's also interesting is that ADC data is particularly ASCENT-03, where they saw a signal for improved response rates in BRCA mutated patients with sacituzumab govitecan. And while we don't fully understand why that is, I think we may be faced one day with kind of that decision point in the post neoadjuvant residual disease setting where we're thinking, do I give a PARP inhibitor? Do I give an ADC? Do I give the combination? I think there's a lot of exciting things in the pipeline for germline BRCA patients because of that unique biology.
Definitely. I think it's a very exciting moment for early breast triple negative. And with the advent of ADCs and immunotherapy, I think it's very very nice option for our patients.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. For more information on this topic, click on the link in the podcast description.